This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm glad to know there's one chant that we all do the same. Yes. You know, it's just like really hard. You're in some Zen center and somebody else says, oh, we've got a new translation. And so then you start doing that translation and then you go back someplace and they're doing the old translation. So that one, we all do the same. That's wonderful. So my name is Misha and I have a group called Zen Heart Sangha, and we were actually just here all weekend doing a sesshin. And I've been sitting in this spot since Friday morning, so feels comfortable. And I was telling the group this morning that the very first time that I came to Jikoji was about a month after I had been ordained a monk. And the only reason I can remember this is because I remember I had a shaved head, and I was wrestling with all this new clothing, because I had been sent by my teacher to ask Kobin a question, because my teacher was Kobin's student, Les K. And I had my new kesa on, and you know how they say the whole nine yards? Well, a kesa actually is 9 yards of material. And you're wrapping it around your body and you're trying to, you know, it's just crazy. Well, when I came, it was either the very end of January or the beginning of February, and it was snowing. It was so beautiful here. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, this is really a special place, because I had never been here. So when I came in, Kobin was sitting here, or there, somewhere in here. And there were at least, I'm sure, 40 people in front, you know, just lined up all the way back. And I was a few minutes late, so I slipped in the back, and I was sort of where Nico is right now. And I don't know how many of you actually were around when Kobin would give talks, but, you know, he had a bit of an accent, and sometimes he would go on for a very long time, like an hour and a half or two, all off the top of his head. And I had been up since 4 o'clock that morning, because I had gone to my Zen center and then come up here later. And so I'm sitting there trying to look very new monkish, you know, very official. And at some point I must have drifted off, because all of a sudden there comes this voice. Oh, and you were just ordained, right? It's like, yes. It's like, oh, shoot, I have completely humiliated myself. And now I'm supposed to go ask him this important question from my teacher, which has to do with a mountain seat ceremony. And Kobin was delightful and very, very kind. And we met again every now and then after that. But the interesting thing is, the Zendo as you see it now was not the Zendo as it was then. For one thing, when you walked in, the whole building moved. Do you remember this?
It was before my time.
Oh, okay. Well, it was a part of the actual, you know, intentional construction to be somewhat earthquake movable, except that the feeling that you got was when it started doing this, it's like, this doesn't feel very stable. But eventually, all of these changes have actually been fairly recent. The bamboo floor is beautiful, and the altar used to be over here, and the wood stove was where the altar is, just on the other side. So many things changed, and it's just beautiful now. I mean, it was always beautiful, but it's actually more beautiful now. So appreciate. So what I've been thinking about a lot lately is generosity. And both generosity of material things, which is important, but generosity of spirit. And realizing how it feels like that is something that we don't experience as much anymore in the world. That we're getting rather miserly about our affection, about our kindness, about our compassion, about our willingness to stand inside of someone else's sandals, as it were. to see the world through someone else's eyes. We're all so intent on what we're doing in the world, and we find it very difficult to have a different point of view. So there's a story. I'm going to have to do it the best I can because I didn't bring it with me, but I realized I wanted to start with this story. It's one of my very favorite teaching stories, and I might have said it here once before, so please forgive me, but there's a lot to unpack in this story. So this story concerns a monastery that had fallen on hard times. Near the end of the 19th century, due to religious persecution, but also to the rise of secularism in the world. This was the mother house in which there were five monks, the abbot and four other monks. And all of the satellite houses had died out. You know, young people weren't coming to be priests or monks anymore. And the father abbot was very distressed about this because they were all over 70 years of age. And he knew if something didn't happen pretty soon, the mother house itself, the core of this particular teaching, was going to die. Well, it happened that these monks had lived in this monastery that was surrounded by woods for so long. And there was a hermitage in the woods. And every now and then, a rabbi from a nearby village would come on a few days of hermitage, and the monks were kind of psychic by this time, and they always knew when the rabbi was at the hermitage. So at one point this happened, and the monks all went to Father Abbot and said, why don't you go ask him if he's got some ideas of what we could do? Well, by this time the Father Abbot is pretty desperate. It's like, okay, anything, you know, well, give it a try. So he goes to the hermitage. Sure enough, the rabbi is there. And he starts to tell him what the difficulty is. And the rabbi commiserates with him and says, oh, yes, the spirit has gone out of the people. People don't come to synagogue anymore either. It is a real problem for us all. So they sit there and commiserate with each other, and they share a cup of tea, and they talk about various things, and a couple of hours go by, and it's finally time for Father Abbot to go back to the monastery. And he says, oh, but I've failed in my mission. Is there anything that you could tell me that might help? Oh, no, not really. All I can say is, well, the Messiah is one of you. So the Father Abbot leaves, and he goes back to the monastery, and all the other monks run up. Well, what did he say? What did he say? And he says, well, you know, he really didn't have any advice. And it was wonderful to meet him after all these years, and we had a great conversation, but there wasn't, you know, any specific thing. But he did say something kind of cryptic at the end. He said the Messiah was one of us, and, well, I don't know what he means. And they all went back to their jobs, their places in the monastery. But each one started to think about this. The Messiah is one of us? Really? Well, so it sort of begged the question of, well, which one of us would it be? So it's like, oh, well, Father Abbot, of course. I mean, it might be him because he is a very holy man. He has led this group for over 30 years. And then they sort of stumble. Well, it couldn't be Brother Eldred. He is so crotchety. But come to think of it, he's often right. In fact, almost always he's right. Oh, but it couldn't be Brother Philip. He is so passive, a real nobody. But it is often the case that he's the one you want when you're sick. He's very good at taking care of people. And then finally they got to this point where they said, oh, but it couldn't be me. Really couldn't be me, could it? Oh, God, would you ask that much of me? So they were all thinking in this way. And so, on the off chance that one of them really was the Messiah, and on the off chance that they themselves were the Messiah, they started treating each other with a great deal more of respect and kindness and generosity than they had been doing, including towards themselves. Well, it so happened that because these woods were very beautiful, many people would come to picnic there. And they hadn't done it a lot, but this feeling started emanating from the monastery, this sort of aura of goodness. And so these people would come, and then they'd go home and they'd tell their friends about this extraordinary place. You really have to come. Come with us next weekend and we'll have a picnic there. And they brought their friends, and more people started showing up. And many of them were young people. And so it happened one day that a young man showed up and got into conversation with one of the monks. And he asked if he could join the order. And then more young people joined the order. Until finally it grew again into a flourishing monastery that passed out that goodness to the community and beyond. All because of what? A cryptic statement. One of you is the Messiah. What was the rabbi thinking? In Judaism, the Messiah has not yet come. They don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. They believe he was a great teacher. So the rabbi was sort of saying, you know, really, the Messiah is any one of you. Or in Buddhism, we would say, we all have this Buddha nature. It's in every single one of us. But if we don't realize it, if we are not reminded of it occasionally, we fall into maybe ways that are not so helpful. So for these monks, when Father Abbot came back and said that, they started looking at each other with new eyes. In every group of people, there are crotchety ones and curmudgeons, people who give rather sharp replies. They don't necessarily mean to be sharp, it's just their nature. And then you have the ones who are very passive, who are never willing to really state their point of view, that are too shy or too scared to say anything at all. And then you have the people who talk all the time. And then you have the people like Father Abbot, who's actually pretty grounded and someone to admire and follow example of. But this happens in every group. Every group I am in my life. At school, in the Sangha, in local community organizations. And it is very easy to dismiss the people you don't get along with. It is very easy to think that this person's just passive nobody or this person's a curmudgeon. You're only seeing one side. And we all have many sides. We're like jewels, many facets. So when they come back, they start thinking about this. One of us is the Messiah, huh? Well, it couldn't be Brother Eldred because he's such a curmudgeon. And yet, looking more closely, it is the case that when he brings something up, he's usually right. In fact, he's often right. So there must be some wisdom there. He might be a curmudgeon, but there's this other part too. And Brother Philip, the passive one, who doesn't like to have someone take care of them when they're ill? And not everybody likes to do that. not everybody is skilled at doing that. So just when you think you've figured somebody out and you've put them in a nice, neat little box, practice asks you to look a little closer. So I was recently at an education conference and was very fortunate. There were two amazing guest speakers. The first one was Viola Davis, the actress, gave a great talk. But the second one was this woman, Shihi Shahzad. Shihi Shahzad is the young woman who ended up mentoring the girl in Pakistan, Malala, who was fighting for the right to be educated as a girl. The powers that be didn't want her to be educated and boarded a bus and shot her in the head. She survived. And all this time, Shizi was her mentor, was there during the surgery, was there afterwards, and she was eventually awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in combination with an Indian man who was also involved in education. So Pakistan and India haven't gotten along very well for years, so this was really a wonderful thing that what they came together over in this Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize, was for education. Anyway, Shizi told this incredible story that I can't tell enough because it was so remarkable. And it was about the fact that we aren't really seeing what is. So she started out by saying at some point, if you think you are without bias, you are not looking closely enough. This was the problem for the monks. They had stopped really seeing each other. And you know as well as I do, this happens with our friends. It happens with husbands, wives, partners. We are together for so long, there's a part of us that really stops seeing the other as they really are, not as the way we want them to be or the way we think they should be or the way they used to be. So she said, you need to look more closely, and here is a perfect example of this. In 1958, I believe, the conductor of the Philadelphia Symphony looked around, and all he saw in his symphony were white men. And he apparently had traveled in Europe and could see that there were many women in these orchestras. And he couldn't understand, why are there no women? We do these auditions. Surely there are women who are capable of being in the symphony. So he decided, along with his board, to have the auditions done slightly differently than they had been in the past. They would be in the front, and there would be a curtain, and the musicians would be behind the curtain, so that they wouldn't be able to tell if it was a male or a female, or someone of color behind the curtain. The auditions happened, and the results basically came out men, still all men. Now, they could have congratulated themselves at that moment and said, well, we did what we could, no bias, we didn't know who they were, we didn't see. But they didn't. They decided to look even more closely and said, something is wrong here. We don't know what. So let's think about this a little bit more. So they asked everyone who had auditioned to come back again. And this time they asked them to take off their shoes. Because it turns out that in 1958, women wore high heels and men wore flat shoes. And that whether it was conscious or not, as soon as they walked on stage, the person knew it was a male or a female, and probably subconsciously demeaned the performance. Because when they did it that way with no shoes, guess what? Half of the auditionees who won the place were women. It It is so hard for us to know our biases, to understand our preferences, to see how our views are always getting in our way. The rabbi was brilliant. He said something that's so off the wall that they couldn't help but think about it. They couldn't help but question themselves about their view of each other. And they had the added motivation of understanding that, you know, if it really was the case that the Messiah was here among us, boy, maybe we could really save our monastery after all, because what could be better than telling everybody, guess what? We have the Messiah here. For whatever reason, they started looking more closely. They started paying attention to each other. And once you start doing that, you actually begin to see what is rather than what you think it is. Your eyes and your heart open. And that is called generosity of spirit. The generosity is to see beyond that first impression, to even see beyond something that you believe that you have seen for years in someone. Because when you do that, you take them out of the box you've put them in. I work in a place where I've worked for over 30 years. The cast of characters changes a little bit each year. We get new people and some people leave. But there's still some people there who have been there as long as I have. We think we know each other. We think we know everything about each other. Oh yes, well that's so-and-so, is how it gets said. Oh yes, well you could expect that from so-and-so because that's how she always expresses herself. I'm not so sure about this. I think that our problem is that it's easier to not look. It's easier to think you already know someone because then you don't have to think about it anymore. And the problem is that when we do that and the person behaves in that manner that we are expecting them to behave in, we have done both of ourselves a disservice. When we expect someone to behave in a certain way, often they do. If I'm expecting you to be hostile towards me, I'm going to be putting off a little energy that's letting you know that I'm having that expectation. Well, that's going to hurt your feelings. And you're going to think, well, the heck with you, and you're going to behave in a hostile fashion. So our expectations of somebody actually create the thing that we have the expectation of. It's this huge, terrible catch-22. And the only way out of it is to understand about change and impermanence and emptiness. When we deeply understand the nature of emptiness, that there is no abiding, permanent self, then we can make room for some movement. So even with these individuals at school that I have some difficulty with, I am always looking for a way to bridge that gap. I know them well enough to know the things that please them, and so I try to bring those things to the forefront as a way of trying to make a connection. So think of the person in your life who is the most difficult for you. Just take a moment to think of that person and bring them into your consciousness. Because everybody's got one. Now, think about what it is about that person that makes you unhappy. What is it in you that is being triggered? What is it in you that does not feel open-hearted? I would suggest that if you can, that the next time you're with that person, that you try to pry open the heart door, just a teeny bit even, and see if something else can come out. See if you can approach that person a little differently and see what happens. Because the fact is, it's all dynamic. There is no self that is not related to all the other selves. We're in a dance. We're always in this dance. And some people don't dance well together. They're clumsy together. They're not in the same timing, but they can still do a dance. There are some people in our lives the dance is easy. You know, just feels like we've been doing this all our lives. But that's not our practice. Our practice is to work with the dancers that we don't work well with, because there's something there for us too. So this weekend, as part of the Sesshin, I chose a koan that had to do with exactly this. Had to do with this generosity of spirit, had to do with seeing deeply into someone else when no one else was. Because that is the other thing that happens. I don't know if this happens to you, but it certainly happens to me. If there's a person that is causing some difficulty for a few people, those few people can then start getting everybody else sort of on their side. Oh yeah, that person, you don't want to hang around with that person. That person's got problems. So now it's already secondhand. You may not have had a problem with that person, but because your friend has had a problem with that person, now you have a problem. And so it goes. And so that person never gets a chance to break out of that box. So this is a story about something like that. It's called Fa Zheng's Recognition. The nun Fa Zheng often shared her clothing and food, giving the best to the nun Hui Su. The other nuns admonished Fa Zheng, saying, "Oh, the nun Hui Su is uncultivated, inarticulate. In fact, when she wanted to study meditation, no one would give her instruction because she is the worst of idiots. Why don't you sow the seeds of generosity in a more spiritually worthy field?" Fa Zheng responded, "One would have to be a saint to know the spiritual accomplishments of the recipient of donations. I'm just a very ordinary person, so I would rather do it this way." Later, the nun Hui Su sponsored a 7-day meditation retreat with the community. And on the third night, when the others arose from meditation, she did not give up. She remained in a deep meditation state until the end of the retreat. And it was only then that the other nuns saw Hui Su's extraordinary abilities. And for the first time, they understood Fa Zheng's insight. So the title of this story is Fa Zheng's Recognition, which in this story can be understood in two ways. There is her recognition of Hui Su, and there is the nun's recognition of her. And when you think about the word recognition, it is recognition, rethinking, reviewing. Hui Su was despised by this group of nuns because she was probably illiterate, and maybe because of that, she didn't know the right jargon, you know. When you've been doing Zen practice for such a long time, you use words like emptiness. And if someone's new in the group, they're thinking, emptiness? Like an empty bucket? What? It's partly because we don't have better words to use, but it is also the case that sometimes we get caught in jargon. Just like at school, we get caught in educational jargon, right? So Hui Su, maybe she doesn't know the jargon, right? So they think she's inarticulate. She tries to express herself, but she doesn't do a good job. And then they bring up this third-hand information. Oh, yeah, when she tried to go to some other teacher, they wouldn't have anything to do with her because she was an idiot. They've put her in this box, the stupid box. And they're saying to Fajang, you shouldn't be giving her all these nice things. She can't possibly appreciate them. There are other people more worthy of your donations. So I was telling my group, it used to be when I went up to the city, San Francisco, and I'd see all these homeless people. And they would all be, you know, with their bowls or their signs. And it was really distressing because I never knew what I should do. It was always a big question in my mind. Do I give money? Do I not? If I give money, what are they going to do with it? Are they going to go out and buy drugs or alcohol? Am I making the situation worse? Oh my goodness, they have a dog. Oh, I should bring food for the dog. Yeah. It was overwhelming, which ended up basically paralyzing me to do nothing. So I thought about it for a long time. I sat with it. And I finally thought, okay, I'm just going to take a certain amount of money with me whenever I go to the city. What I did was I packaged up pennies in 50-cent rolls. It was very heavy. I would just take all these rolls of pennies, and I would give two to every person on the street until they were gone. And I didn't worry about what it was being used for, and I didn't make any judgment about it. It was just handed it over and went on. Because Fajang's point is, she can't judge it. How can anybody judge another person's spiritual development? And in fact, how can anyone really truly judge anyone else's life? You know, as a teacher, I talk to lots of people in very private, intimate, confidential ways. I have yet to talk to somebody who didn't have some serious problem in their life, something that they were having to do, something that had happened to them, something that happened in their family. All it does is make me more compassionate. You know, there's that saying, you know, take care of everyone you meet because you do not know the struggles they are fighting inside. We don't know. We think we know people. We think that we, from their outward actions, that we can judge who they are or what they are. And then we make a decision and we either write them off or we take them to our bosom and make them our new best friend. When in fact, in this case, Fajang probably didn't know anything about Hui Su, but what she saw, she saw how the other nuns despised her. When you see that in the world, and you see it a lot of it's racial, a lot of it's religious, you need to step forward as an ally. That's what that is. That is what Fajang did. She'd make a big deal out of it. She didn't put the other nuns down. She didn't say, well, you terrible people, you. She just said, oh, you know, you'd have to be a saint to really understand the spiritual development of someone who receives donations, and I'm just an ordinary person, so this is how I do it. When I go to the city, I am just an ordinary person. I don't know how to solve the homeless problem. The best minds in the business are trying to figure it out, and no one seems to know what to do. So that's the way I handle it. I'm sure everyone in this room has a way of handling it because we all have to deal with it. It's in front of us. So Fajang says, this is how I'm going to do it. But I think probably because these other monks were clearly despising Hui Su, when she gave her donations, she tried to give the best things to Hui Su to encourage her, to let her know, there's one person here who does not despise you. There is one person here who, for whatever reason, is on your side. Even if I don't know you very well. Even if I don't know what your motivations are, if I see you and I truly look deeply and carefully, what I am going to see is that there is more than one side of you. I can't possibly, I've lived with my husband for 40 years. I still don't know everything about him. He constantly surprises me. I hope I surprise him sometimes. This is the value of long relationships, of sangha friendships, of commitment to practice. It's the opportunity to see other things about people that you thought you knew. And more importantly, to see things about yourself that you thought you knew. Somebody recently said something about, but myself is so boring. It's like, you're not looking closely enough. I know you really well, and even so, you're not looking closely enough. There's incredible depth there, and she's closer to that end of life than to that. And I said, you know, the whole point of being given this body-mind is to explore it thoroughly with great curiosity and joy. Because this is the only one you can actually know that well. You know, I can try to know Doug. I can try to know Hogan. I know some of my students for a long time. But the only person I can really know that intimately is this one here. And this is what our practice is asking us to do. This is the true generosity that you are all doing right now. You come here and you sit on this cushion and you watch your breath arising and falling and arising and falling, and then you see it go off thinking. And then you begin to notice that there are patterns to that thinking and that none of it is actually real. You know, a lot of times you're pasting, a lot of times you're futuring, and then you come back to your breath when you realize it, and now you are presenting, at least for a moment. Because this is the only thing that is real, is this present moment. So, Fa Zheng does this incredibly generous thing. Not in the donation she gives. We all do that. It feels nice, but really and truly, the most generous thing that you can do is actually see the person in front of you as they are. When I came back from Tassajara the first time, after 3 months, 3 months of having a particular job, I was the chidin for the altar. Learned how to trim candles. I'm an expert candle trimmer. All my meals were taken care of. The tenzo and the fukaten took care of the food. The servers, the doans, you know, I was a doan, so I learned how to do that. But so much was taken care of for me. I didn't have to make any choices. I knew what I was going to wear every day. I knew that whatever I was eating was what was being given to me. You know, you didn't get to go to the cook and say, oh, tomorrow would you make this for me? I knew what I was going to be doing every moment of the day. There was a schedule, and you followed it. The only thing I didn't know was how I was going to spend my little half day off. And that was a huge thing. Oh, do I take a walk or do I wash my clothes? But when I got home, I was suddenly faced with, oh my goodness, I have to do everything myself. I have to cook. I have to clean. I have to decide what I'm going to wear today. Suddenly I wasn't in a community of 60 people all working together. And that was when I realized how generous that community had been with me and with each other. But one of the things I had to do right away was go to the store. It was a Safeway, as I recall. And I remember going in, and I had my cart. I was coming in, and I was in the fresh food section. Now, you have to remember, for 3 months, I had been surrounded by the same 60 people, all of whom were practicing together, speaking together, studying together, sewing together, chanting together, blowing off steam together. Here I am in the Safeway. There's 6 or 7 other people in the fresh food section. They've all got their carts. Nobody is looking at anybody else. They are all intent upon the fruits and vegetables. To the point that someone's cart comes up to one side of me and she reaches over and takes whatever it was that was in front of me, puts it in her cart, and walks on. I was so struck by this. I wasn't offended. It was just like, wow. I'm here, right? I'm not invisible, am I? Because when I was at Tassajara, you were almost too visible. Everything you did was being watched by everybody else, and everyone felt that it was their right to come and tell you if you didn't do it the way they thought you should be. Here I'm in suddenly a situation where there's these people who are acting like no one else is in the store but them. And I had this huge revelation. This is the most unkind, ungenerous thing of all. We invisibilize each other. We stand in elevators. We stand at street corners. We go to stores together. And we do not acknowledge each other. The most generous thing that you can do is sit on your cushion and get to know this one here thoroughly, so that you can do the second most generous thing and go out and acknowledge all beings. That is actually the first step in our vow to save all beings. You have to meet them first. You can't just decide to go out and save them. This was the missionaries' problem. They didn't understand that. You have to meet each person completely, look them in the eyes, look them in the heart, talk to them, see them. We're dying for this. We all want to be seen. This is what came out of this story of Fa Zhang saw Huisu. And then the other story, those monks finally saw each other, and look what happened, because it's a true story, by the way. The fact is, we're all a little afraid. We're a little afraid of rejection. And so we don't reach out. But if we as practitioners cannot do that, then what is all this sitting for? We are here to open our hearts. And yes, they're going to close down a little, depending on where and what we're doing, but our job is to keep prying them open and allow the love and the kindness and the generosity and the understanding, the deep, deep understanding that we are not separate. You can't live without all those people and all those dogs and cats and redwood trees and oak trees and the water. It is true that nothing is separate from you. The very air you breathe, you're all breathing in and out the same air. This is the understanding that we have to come to on our cushion, and the understanding that then we have to take back out into the world. Thank you so much. I think I used up all my time.
I think you might be able to time for questions.
You think? Okay. So if somebody had a question. Yes.
Just as we started, I felt a real joy in myself hearing your voice with the just the opening chant, and when you told when you mentioned how it was so pleasing to you that it was the chant that you were expecting, you know, kind of, I could really relate to how things can flow if there's not all of a sudden an unexpected word that, oh, did I do that wrong? Or
which I was waiting to do.
Yeah, but it never came, and there was something that was really uplifting about the way you, there was a bit of melody to your voice, which was really lovely. You mentioned, so somehow the idea of translation came up. Oh, right, it was, of course, in that context, mm-hmm. different new translations. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned things you noticed about the Zendo. Mm-hmm. And it struck me how that's just a recent translation of what the Zendo is. It's mm-hmm. just a translation. It'll change.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it will.
And then on the translation thing lingered with me on your story, the lovely story of the two nuns and the one who was being very generous towards the other. I like that. And then the other story of the group in the dwindling temple, that there was this one little idea got nudged in there that was so helpful. And the idea of translation struck me as I thought, maybe if someone was, suppose this story is looked at 1,000 years from now and someone is digging up this ancient language and they're translating it, it's somehow very easy to think that the Messiah is one of you. Could be translated as something like, when you are one, the Messiah is there.
Right.
Right. And it will be translated that way sometime in the future when we look back at this. Mm-hmm. And it will be more obvious and direct that... Mm-hmm.
Well, and we have the same conundrum, just generally, with the Buddhist teachings, because they're all coming to us as translations. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, as you say, they suddenly have a new life because of that. And it may be slightly different, but it's the spirit that has to get passed forth,
yeah.
Not exactly the words.
Yeah. The spirits of... recognition,
right.
Respect, respecting. You know, I've heard respect used in the same way, to mm-hmm. re-look.
Re-look.
Yeah, re-look. Look in this moment now. Mm-hmm. And this idea of humility. I don't know. I don't know what you are, actually. I shouldn't judge what you are or aren't. Mm-hmm. Humility seems to be a very important component in being present. I don't know. And it's okay. I don't know whether this other nun is the one that has the great gift or doesn't. And also I feel the culture that we're in right now, because that story about the nuns had a lot to do with, what do you do with your resources? I've got some extra capacity. Where do I put it?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, predominant culture that I've lived in and benefited from would often take a look around and say, where's the rising star? Where's the one that's going to be the new Messiah? Let's push some resources towards that one that we already know is...
Right.
Yeah.
The more fruitful field.
Right, right.
Yes.
More bang for the buck.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Rather than the resources always going to, well, struggling.
Right.
Who seems to be struggling? Who's not getting resources from everyone else? Mm. Who are people spreading stories about and being biased against?
Mm. Well, you know, there's a great story about Suzuki Roshi, how he would go buy vegetables every day for his wife, and he would often specifically choose the bruised ones because he knew that no one else would choose them and that by the next day they would be bad. Mm. And so he would very specifically take those home and they'd cut out the bad parts and use all the good parts. Mm. I always was touched by that. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to make a comment? Or? Yeah.
I just had a hard time remembering this one phrase you mentioned, and it was, I think it was like, there is no absolute self of permanence.
Okay, so this sort of definition of emptiness?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the way that I've sort of framed it for myself is that there is no permanent abiding self. So that it's kind of like Windows 2.0. Well, in every moment you're 2.0, 2.1, 2.2, you know, it's iterations of you. But you also realize that in each of those iterations, you are slightly different. You might not realize it, but for instance, after you eat food, there's definitely something changing in your body. And even as you're taking in air and letting out air, those are in the physical way. But it's also the case that in just the more spiritual way, that when you are with a group of people, you are changed just by being with that particular group of people. So there's never a you that you can kind of put your finger on, which is very encouraging, actually, because it means that we can grow and change.
Yeah, it reminded me of a phrase I saw that said, you know the center by seeing the periphery.
Well, and that's that part about having a different perspective as well. Thank you. Well, I just heard the dinner bell. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.